Paul recognized that he was nothing in one sense, but yet he realized that he was someone that God had made and God had chosen. He said, I live. Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. I can do all things. He didn't say Christ can do all things through me. He could have said that, but he said, I can do all things. You see, there's still, he recognizes his own abilities and gifts and so on. And there's got to be this ability to look upon oneself as being worth something. There's no question about that. The celebrant doesn't have to ask about that. As a matter of fact, in professional counseling situations, it's very obvious. You shake hands with a person. You can tell a lot from a handshake. The cold fish handshake. The bone crusher. You can tell a lot from the way a person shakes hands. And watch how they cross the floor and take a seat. And watch how they walk. Look at how they sit. The attitude. The expression. Look at the way they dress. All these things, how they're groomed, all these things tell what a man looks upon himself as, and the woman likewise. So personality factors, in particular the sex role, is of tremendous consequence. Yes. Righto. Then the sixth area is the area of attitudes to procreation. Now you'll notice I put it last. It's very important to remember that when God made woman and brought her to the man, there is no mention at that point of Scripture of procreation. No question of children. It wasn't good for man to be alone. God provided the woman. He didn't provide children. He provided the woman. See? Now, from the time of Calvin particularly, there has been this insertion in many marriage ceremonies regarding the purposes of marriage. The Church of England, in the present ceremony, put as number one the procreation of children, to be brought up in the fear and the admonition of the Lord. And certainly, some of the early thinkers thought that this was the first and the only purpose of marriage. But others have thought otherwise. I think Calvin, for example, began to realize there was more to it than simply being in the way of procreating children. That there was this element of mutual comfort and companionship, and that children were something rather different. That whilst they were the outcome of a physical relationship, they were nevertheless a direct gift from God Himself. And that the parents were being put in the position of special stewardship, being given the loan of little children, babies of children who were to grow up under the stewardship and care of a couple who had found companionship and communion with each other. Now, it's a rather important thing, this. Because the attitude, you see, then, of each partner to sex itself and to having children must be looked into. I'm going to say more about sex later on. The question of what they think of having children, of beginning a family, yes or no, and when, and what they think about the raising of children, how they go about it, what their attitudes are to be about education and teaching the child the fear of the Lord, and so on. Now, these are our six areas which are of major importance. Now, following these three initial interviews, and we've got a lot of information now about the partners in front of us, and that's just the beginning. We haven't started counseling yet. This has probably taken 2 hours, at least. Now we can start with giving some counsel. Now, not that I'm being critical of any celibate who only gives an hour or less counseling, but I'm emphasizing the fact that to do proper counseling takes time. Now, what's the kind of matter to be introduced? Well, here are several points. I've written 11 points down here. The very first, and in my opinion, the most important, is an outline of the scriptural principles underlying marriage. Now, of this I have no doubt whatsoever. It has been my custom, in taking a couple, either that I'm going to marry, or those who have come for pre-marital counseling professionally, and many of them do, to start a Genesis and go through many portions of Scripture outlining the institution of marriage, the plan of marriage, the ideals of marriage, the outcome of marriage, and all the rest of it. The institution of marriage, for example, is something that can never be stressed too much. This portion in Genesis 2 that I've briefly made reference to. Fascinating story, you know. Did you notice how I read that portion? There was found no help meet for him. Some of us say, help meet. No, that's wrong. Hebrew doesn't say that. They couldn't find a help suitable for man. That's the point. And how God brings all the animals in front of Adam. I think this is marvelous. Most exciting. First zoologist. And what are they all coming in front of him for? To be given names? Oh no. They're looking for a help suitable for the loneliness of man. And they go through the whole lot, all the phyla, and they can't find a help suitable for man. And this is when God steps in. So here we have a most wonderful opportunity of counseling young people, and if they're non-Christians, my word, God cares for man. He knew Adam's need, and looked all the trouble he went to get a comfort for Adam. You can preach a great gospel address in that. Great gospel address. Marriage institution. And therefore, of course, because God brought it into being, it's something that has got the characteristic of God and that it never changes. Change and decay and all around I see, O thou who changest not abide with me. And the thing that God has planned and instituted, they can never change either. Last year I was in one of the tapes, and I hope that you hear the tapes of last year, particularly the one on the relevance of marriage. It's a very important one. I was pointing out that a few months before that, I had been invited by the Ministers Fraternal of New South Wales City to go and have two seminars with 5th and 6th year students in two co-educational schools. And I went to both these schools. I spoke for an hour to each one, and then we had an hour of discussion. You see, in my particular sphere of work, my calls to speak on this subject are very widespread, as you could probably imagine, to all sorts of people in all sorts of groups. The discussion was something that I will never forget. I had always realized that marriage was looked upon as being a little bit old hat by some young people. But the intensity of their feelings, particularly in the second school I went to, was almost frightening. What's the use of a piece of paper? Two people love each other, that's all that's required. And some of the arguments were brought up were not easy to counter. And therefore I feel very strongly that in premarital counseling there has got to be tremendous emphasis on the holiness of the institution of marriage. And this is one reason that I personally feel that the wording and the manner of conducting a marriage is of vital importance. I am very concerned, for example, about the tendency to abbreviate marriage ceremonies. I think that the abbreviation of a marriage ceremony takes away a great deal from registering it in the minds of the parties concerned and in the congregation. And I believe as Christian leaders that it is our responsibility to use every opportunity in a day of a breaking up society to push home the holiness, the sacredness of the institution of Christian marriage. The second point that I believe that's got to be dealt with in regard to the scriptural background is the purpose of marriage. And first and foremost, I feel that the treatment of loneliness must be brought forth. And secondly, marriage being used as a means of the prevention of sexual sin. Because, of course, it was well emphasized by Paul that marriage was there for that purpose, to provide the outlet for mankind in his physical needs so that there would be no sin involved in the doing of this. And thirdly, the procreation of children, which I believe are the gift of God, and they are something that and in passing I make this point, the gift of a God who is far above any kind of control of conception. And I think this is one thing, of course, we must discuss in just a moment. But the fourth thing that must be emphasized about the scriptural principles of marriage, and I spend a lot of time with this one, and I think that this is something that many people tend to forget. If this particular thing is emphasized, there's a basic approach in marriage relationships automatically, and that is marriage being accepted by God as a universal type of the relationship between Christ and the church. I'm speaking of Christ, the heavenly bridegroom, and the church, Ephesians 5. And of course, once you start speaking like that, to Christians especially, then obviously you're on the way to saying, well, the husband got to act as Christ acted, and the wife's got to behave as the believer acts to her Lord. And this brings us to the second major thing about the scriptural principle, and that's the relationships within marriage. It has been suggested that the needs of women were given a great priority by God in the planning of marriage relationships. We live, of course, in a day of women's liberation. It is quite astonishing that, from my own experience, a great number of women who have been active participants in women's liberation eventually come to see psychiatrists, mainly because of the fact that they begin to realize that the stand which they are taking is completely out of keeping with the female personality. Now, God made that personality, and he could supply from the very beginning the needs of the woman. We tend to think about the needs of the man, but God saw to it that the needs of the woman were to be fulfilled too. And if we look at them, we find a basis for understanding why Ephesians 5 tells us of wives submitting to husbands and of husbands loving wives. A reason why wives have got to reverence or respect their husbands, and how husbands have got to take the lead in guiding the marriage. For there are two psychological characteristics of women which are not present in men. and it becomes more and more obvious as the woman becomes older. The first is the need to be loved. Not to love, but to be loved. And the second is the need to be led. The need to be led. Now these are things which lead to the attitude in the woman of submission and respect. Now of course many, many women are very frightened of this word submit, and particularly of the word obey. And I think that before we can say to a young couple, now we'll put in the word obey, you've got to explain why. I believe that it is necessary to do this. You've got to give them a reason for this. Why did God put it in? Why did he bother? He could have left it out. But he didn't. And he used the word submit. Now, as I say, submission is not subordination. But it is a recognition of a kind of a hierarchy, with God being the head of the man, and the man being the head of the woman. Therefore, God is the head of both, but directly of the man. And he is the one who has the, as it were, the divine legal responsibility of giving account of the marriage. That doesn't mean to say that the man is superior to the woman. It does not mean to say that the woman is superior to the man. It's simply pointing up the fact. That's all. You see, that one thing is better than the other if the two things are different. If I had an apple in this hand and an orange in this hand, I couldn't say this apple is better than... Well, you can't say better than the orange because they're two different things. If I had two apples, I could say that apple's better than that one, or that orange is better than that orange. But I can't compare the two, they're different. And this comes back to the complementary nature of man and woman. They are different in their roles. They are different in their creation, as we've already indicated. And the woman comes to the man as her head, remembering that he represents in the type Christ himself, and she the believer. It's a very wonderful situation when the woman is allowed to express her opinions. She still has the right to disagree with her husband, and certainly his attitude to her must be one of tenderness and understanding. But her attitude has always got to be one of cooperation. That's the important thing. If her husband's decision happens to be wrong, she mustn't say, "I told you so." But she's got to believe that God, who is the head of the man, of her husband, will be able to deal with it and her husband put him right. If he is right, then she will have the more confidence in her husband and be more prepared to submit. Of course, loving, being loved by the husband, if the husband loves the wife so much, he may actually forget to lead. And I can always remember one a youngish woman who a very outgoing person, and she married a fellow who was the model of he's a model husband, you know, a small imitation of the real thing. How about you, Graham? Sorry. But the point is that he was very quiet and terribly polite. You know, after you, darling. The marriage didn't go on for very long before one day she came to see me and she said, "The marriage is hopeless." I said, "Why is it hopeless?" "Oh," she said, "he's too polite. He comes in and he says, 'Where will we go tonight?' 'Your choice, darling.'" And she said, "I just need him to come in and say, 'We are going to so-and-so tonight,' to make the decisions." And this is one of these elements of being led, the need to be led. It's important. Now, portions dealing with submission then have got to be read to the parties. Both of them. We must always be very careful that the woman never feel that she's being made a doormat. Never. And the portions that deal with it are Ephesians 5, 22 to 25, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1, which has a special significance, and 1 Peter chapter 3 verses 5 and 6. And I would refer you particularly to Philip's translation of verses 5 and 6 of 1 Peter 3, which reads as follows. This was the secret of the beauty of the holy women of ancient times, who trusted in God and were submissive to their husbands. Sarah, you will remember, obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. So submission is something that is a trans consequence. It fits in with the psychological needs of the woman. So the obey is not something that just might be put in. It's something that is almost necessary. And of course, the husbands have got to love their wives. And here I believe it's so important, you know, to go through quietly with an open Bible, 1 Peter chapter 7. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 7 to 12. And this particular portion is one that I think all celebrants ought to know in detail, because it deals with the characteristics of husbands towards their wives, and then it speaks of them both together. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with your wives according to knowledge. In other words, with understanding. Giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, but being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. You see, so many things can come up here. Anyway, verse 8, and this is speaking of husbands and wives particularly, although it says, be ye all of one mind, it's virtually a word to each of them. That's what it amounts to. Finally, be ye of one mind. How can two walk together unless they be agreed? Hosea 3:3. Having compassion one of another. Pity. Pity. Merciful. Blessed are the merciful. Love as brethren. Hard to think of husbands and wives loving each other as brothers. But I think the idea here is the idea of sharing. And I often think of that song that became very popular a few years ago, There's Room on My Horse for You. You remember the two little boys? And then one went into battle, and he lay dying. And the little, his brother that came up, who had played with him and shared the toy horse so many years before, he comes up on his horse, and there's the young boy dying. I won't leave you here. There's room on my horse for you. The idea of the sharing. This is the sharing of husbands and wives. Be pitiful. Be courteous. And all the discourtesy of some husbands and wives. You know, I could tell you a lot of stories of things I've had and come across. Discourtesy is too weak a word. The violence, even in Christian couples, by the way. I've had them in my office. Eyes flashing, tongues like rapiers. Tearing each other to pieces because they felt that they were saved and upset. But God hearing all these things, oh. You see, to me that suggests the importance of the counsel of celebrant doing much more than just celebrating a marriage. And it says, not rendering evil for evil, railing for railing, but contrarywise, blessing. Blessing one another. I think it's a wonderful portion that for celebrants to give. 1 Peter chapter 1, chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. Well now, the husbands are going to love their wives then. To give in a very, very real way to them as Christ gave. Now, the other thing, of course, is the fourth thing about the scriptural principle is the matter of human bodies. Physical possession. We tend to live to ourselves. Our passions are our own. Our thoughts and desires and instincts, they're our own. But not so when it comes to the living out of God's word within a marriage. And therefore I feel it's important in counseling to bring the young people to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And there we read a word like this, reading from verse 3. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. I like Connie Beer's translation of this. He says, let the husband live in the intercourse of affection with his wife. I like that. And likewise also, the wife must give the husband his due. Because, verse 4, wife have the right to do as she pleases with her own body. The husband, and likewise also the husband, hath the power of his own body with the wife. Now that's a big thing to say. And that's the kind of thing that gives the basis for monogamy. One husband, one wife. Because my body is no longer my own. It belongs to my wife. She's got the say. And I've got the say with her. Defraud ye not one another. In other words, stop refusing each other what is due. Don't withhold your relationship from each other, except to be with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. But then come together again, lest Satan tempt you for your incontinency. So this is another aspect that has got to be brought into it. The scriptural basis of the marriage relationship. And I think this is absolutely number one. Now number two is discussion regarding sex. Now I bring this up with a little bit of hesitancy in one sense, but I think that I ought to. I think those of us who are getting a bit longer in the tooth are very reticent to talk on this subject. This may well be because of our own upbringing and our own inhibitions. But we've got to recognize two things. Number one, that as long as time will exist, that the subject of sex is a holy one. Never one to be bandied around, even in a counseling situation. And secondly, we've got to recognize that in society today, especially amongst young people, that the subject of sex is almost a byword. You can hardly go into any group without hearing some kind of allusions to sex, to sexual relationships and so on. Now, there are some celebrants who, in my opinion, are not suitable to discuss this kind of subject. And I think that every celebrant counselor should be very careful to prayerfully and carefully examine his own motives in talking about this subject. Because there can come a great fascination in talking and discussing this kind of subject with young people. And if the celebrant is in doubt, I believe that the rule is don't discuss, but always refer on to somebody else. And in passing, let me advise that no couple should go away from a celebrant's interview without being reminded of the necessity or the benefits of having a medical examination from a doctor before marriage. Now, I don't want to go into any of the details of sex itself. I would make just one point. It's a very important thing, I believe, for those who are prepared to talk on this, to know a little bit more about the subject than is usually known. Today we read a great deal about the importance of female fulfillment within the sexual role. And there are women's magazines, of course, and other publications have laid tremendous stress on this. And I know that there are so many people coming to doctors and psychiatrists today to discuss this very matter. And inevitably, it is possible that you may be approached on the subject yourself, so you should know a little bit about it. Now, all I want to say is just this, that the question of female fulfillment in a sexual relationship is of major importance. Now, this is something which is only recently beginning to be realized. And the fulfillment, which is the prerogative of the woman, is completely different in quality and in meaning from the fulfillment of the male. And in fact, it is so different that the absence of it within the woman potentially leads to emotional problems in health. For it is only in female fulfillment, this is something which emphasizes the difference between the two creations, that woman has and the fulfillment which is the prerogative of the woman is completely different in quality and in meaning from the fulfillment of the male. And in fact, it is so different that the absence of it within the woman potentially leads to emotional problems in health. For it is only in female fulfillment, this is something which emphasizes the difference between the two creations, that woman herself has an inbuilt mechanism to deal with the anxieties which are peculiarly female, and to gain a sense of positivism and optimism, of self-confidence, to deal with the problems of tomorrow. Now, I'm going to say no more about it than that. But this is something which I think is well worth reading. And there are quite a lot of books on this. And I'd like just to mention this little book called Sexual Responsibility in Marriage by Maxine Davis, published by Fontana. And it's a very excellent book. It is not written by a Christian, by the way, but the material in it is sound material. It's a very good book, and there are other ones over there that Graham has got, so you can have a look at them afterwards. Now, it is very likely, of course, that there will be some question about honeymoons, and I think you've got to be prepared to face up to that as well. One thing, a counselor under no circumstances must ever quote his. That is absolutely out. You are not there to discuss your experiences and your opinions. You are there to pass on knowledge which you have learned and taken in. If you bring in your own experiences, then you're actually putting in a potential point of weakness in the discussion. Now, the third thing that has to be discussed is the question of money. The Christian attitude to stewardship of money. How important it is. How to handle finances. The question of budgeting. I can't help but think, of course, in this regard, of Ananias and Sapphira. Acts chapter 5. The importance that was laid on the fact that all money belongs to the Lord, and that the responsibility of a Christian couple is not to decide just how much to give to the Lord, but how much to keep. And that's a different thing altogether. And this is the point of time that the celebrant counselor can get this over. to work out the budgeting of it as well, and the practical aspects. There's got to be a certain amount there, and so on. You see, there are problems can come up with this kind of situation. Take an example. Here's a young man, husband. He buys a car which he can't afford. He doesn't, his wife doesn't realize that he's going to need to be recognized to have prestige. But if she had been reared in his family, she would have understood. They were so different, you see, in their upbringings, this particular couple. And this is where you've got to begin to look into the back of why people do certain things with money, and to try and explain why there are different attitudes. He, for example, this particular fellow, may have come from a home in which the father and the mother would have emphasized the importance of having big things, showy things. That was the only way to be recognized. They had to be the boss in the street, the big ones in the street. And so they had to have the biggest house. They always had to be the best dressed, and so on. Now this particular wife, she came from a different background altogether. She couldn't understand this business of putting out money just to get prestige. She saved it, kept it up, kept it by her. Now that's the kind of different attitude that has to be dealt with in premarital counseling, to try and get a more logical approach, a balanced approach. The fourth thing is housing, where to live. And incidentally, as Christians, this is a very important thing. The question, for example, of local witness is important. Which church connection? Is this where the Lord would have them? If they're active Christians and they're involved in Christian work, well, this must come into it and be discussed. The housing itself, is it adequate for living space? Is there privacy in it? You know, the number of marriages that are ruined by lack of privacy is appalling. Especially if they go to live with mum and dad and the walls aren't all that thick. Marriages break up for things like that. And of course, there's always the case of that I can remember very, very well, of a couple in an Australian city that came to me. He was a son of a very wealthy family. He was an only son. His family decided to give a wonderful wedding present. Do you know what it was? It was a house. And do you know where it was? At the bottom of the Payne's garden. And the Payne's even went to the length of making a little, nice little door in the fence so they could go backwards and forwards. 4 months that marriage lasted. And it appeared to be so ideal. So housing, you see, is something that's got to be looked into. Don't, by the way, necessarily advise what happened to me when I was married. Within a few weeks of my wife and I being married, we left our parents 12,000 miles behind. Mind you, there were perhaps many advantages in some ways, but don't advise that, if we were too much. The fifth thing is the question of further education. Because don't forget that people are not adults until they're 25 years of age. A person of 24 is still, theoretically at least, a child. Nobody is grown up until they are 25 years of age. That's when growth stops physically, when it stops emotionally. In other words, from that point on, all hope is lost. No improvement possible. But education, you see, is something that can go on. But you've got to be very careful in advising about further education. One can think of some couples and the husband goes on for 30 years going to night school. I can think of one particular person who has got a most amazing string of degrees and diplomas and things after his name. And that's all he's got. He's lost his marriage because of it. And he's not even employed. using always degrees. So you see, this question of education comes into it. The sixth thing is employment. Is the husband in the right job? Or the question, of course, of a working wife. That's got to be discussed. And that brings, of course, the question of, if children come, what then? And the counselor must be very quick to point out, and this is fact, that any mother will do more than half of all that she ever will do for a child during the first 3 years of that child's life. In other words, I believe, personally, that you ought to say to a mother with a young child, she's the only teacher of that child for 3 years, and if she's not there, the child is no teacher. Of course, there are occasions when the financial situation makes it absolutely essential that she works at least part-time, but it's ideal for her to be with the baby at least for the first 3 years. So the question of seventhly, of hereditary and genetic factors affecting possible children. This is something, of course, that should be referred to a doctor. Things like mental deficiency in a family, and certain deformities and certain types of diseases, particularly wasting diseases, by the way. And eighthly, there's the question, of course, of church affiliation. Now, I've left that quite late, not because it's least important, because it's not, it's very important. But again, the chances taken to discuss differences in belief, the choice of church, the stewardship of time and so on, things like that. The ninth area to be discussed is in-laws. The tenth one, children. And the 11th one is leisure time. Leisure time activities. You say that's a funny thing to put in. But you know, it's terribly important. Husbands and wives who do things together in their leisure, a common interest, but not always common. Now, I'm going to make a suggestion here that might surprise some of you. There are certain activities in each sex which are very important in maintaining this sex role differentiation that I spoke of previously. For example, here's a young fellow who's been playing rugby football, rugby union preferably. Now, he gets married. The question is, did he give up his rugby? Well, he'll probably have to give it up sooner or later with a broken neck or something, but should he give it up immediately? And the answer is no. Because you see, the very fact that he plays rugby, he goes onto a field, there he goes running out to the field, muscles rippling, to the oohs and the ahs of those in the crowd, and he immediately feels, I'm a male. And he has, as it were, he's part of a group of men. They're identified as men. And this helps him, his own choir. Might be a men's discussion group. But it's something organized, that's the point, with other men. The woman's needs are much simpler. She doesn't play rugby, for one thing. And she certainly doesn't sing in a male. She needs something much less organized in order to maintain her femininity. For example, the encouragement, and the husband must know of this, to have a cup of tea in the morning with the next door neighbor, or for a regular visit to the hairdresser. See, the hairdresser is not the important thing. It's the fact that she's relating in a female group. And these things are terribly important practical points. But on top of that, there must come some kind of common leisure interest. Whatever it is, they can choose what they like. So these are things that I believe are very important. Now, my time's almost gone. 7 minutes. I want to speak briefly, lastly, about post-marriage counseling. Now, obviously, post-marriage counseling is easier with those who have had pre-marital counseling from the same counselor, because the counselor already knows what's gone before. And, of course, he's got his notes all carefully locked up. Now, There are many problems come up after marriage. Immediately after marriage, for example, you might get the emergence of the real partners. You know, every human being tends to have a picture in their own mind of the kind of person they're going to one day fall in love with and marry. I once asked Margaret, my wife, what kind of a person she thought she would like to marry. And you know, somehow it didn't correspond to me at all. I'm rather glad, actually. The point, of course, is, you see, that we've all got concepts what we want our wives or husbands to be like. And during the days of courtship, we appear to have these things to some extent. But what we don't realize is that during courtship, and even during engagement, and even up to the wedding day, and even up to the first honeymoon night, we all put on what we make ourselves up into something which basically we are not. And the person, if you, for example, were to go home today and just look at your wives and consider, is she the person that you once courted? I'm quite sure you would realize that it's been a big change. Now, even quickly after a honeymoon, this false front disappears. The false front's there in order to win the other party. In America, I'm told that millions and millions of dollars are spent in every state, in every city, in every town by people who are desperately trying to maintain the way they look before marriage, to try and save marriages.
But this, that's always so. A Christian couple who is deserving and win the Lord.
Yes. Well, I think that even here there's a problem, and I'll tell you why. When I'm talking of this false front, we're talking basically of people who tend to be just that little bit different. Even if they're Christians, they can put on a little bit of a false front, but the moment that the marriage is finished, there comes this dropping. And this drop is the thing that is very often one of the most dangerous things that can ever happen in a marriage. Now, of course, it is true that if the couple have before the Lord found each other, that this will be obviated, at least in great part. But there's always this possibility. She's no longer quite, for example, as concerned about her appearance. She no longer has got to look the last word in, in fashion, for example. I know that this point. He has won her, she has won him. And this drop means that there's an emergence of the real persons, and it's a potential danger. And the number of young people that come back, as I say, even after a honeymoon, and they realize that they're different to what they thought. So that the counselor must warn people who are being married of this problem. Sexual problems, of course, they'll come up as well. Perhaps questions of painful relationships or of non-consummation of marriage. Do you know that there are many marriages which are not consummated? I recently came across one couple, and they were in their middle 40s. They'd been married, I think, about 14, 15 years. Marriage was never consummated. Now, that's a very serious problem. But nobody liked to admit that this was the case, but eventually they had to. 14 or 15 years later, little could be done, by the way. Very little, because it was too late. And then, of course, in later marriage, there are other sexual problems, and the counselor may come across this. And one particular one is so-called frigidity. Frigidity is a very rare thing, really. It can always be treated. But this is the kind of thing that you might be up against. And then, of course, there's the problem of children and the effect of them in marriage. But there's one other thing, and that is the drifting apart of partners. Perhaps I want to close with this to give you a little picture. I want you to imagine, here's a man, there's a woman. They're in their teen years. They begin to fall in love. Now watch what happens. Watch. They start to come together. And they come quite close together. They're in love. And he says, I love you. Do you love me? Yes, I love you. Will you marry me? Yes, I'll marry you. And at this point they're engaged. They're still just a little bit apart, so you see. And then during engagement they slowly come close together. Then they come to the point of marriage. And they're one. Now watch. There they are. Husband, wife. Now one. In marriage. Husband, wife. Now what happens is this. 2 or 3 years go by and along come some children. One at a time perhaps. There's a child down here. Now watch what happens to the wife. Immediately, she diverges towards the children. And she remains like that. Notice the distance between the husband and wife now. And they go along to about 30, 35 years of age, maybe 40. Now he's in the world of business. It's a very hard world, a cutthroat world. In order to be successful, he's got to go to his business and be married to his business. So he actually is diverted as well. So now they're both diverted, further apart. But the time goes on, and the children, they fall in love, and they become engaged, and they marry. So it's time now for the wife to go back to where she was. And she comes back to where she was. But her husband isn't there. He's married to his work. So there's this gap here. And that's got to be maintained over a period of years until retirement. And that gap there, tragically, in Christian couples too, is not always filled. And this is where the celebrant counselor must again come into the picture to deal with this kind of problem. Well, brethren, I've spoken for a long time. I could have spoken for much longer. You'll be glad to know I'm going to stop. But I do hope that what I have said is sufficient to emphasize to you that a married celebrant's responsibilities are not just to conduct a ceremony. They are to take the part of being one who has knowledge, specialized, and who can give it and share it and teach it, and who, above all, can initiate a relationship with young people at a critical stage of their lives, that relationship which will grow as the years go by and become a friendship of tremendous value to the young people concerned.